fourth case, number 11-1662, et cetera, PCS Nitrogen Incorporated versus Ashley.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Good morning, Mr. Murray.
This case, as Your Honors know, was brought by Ashley against only my client, PCS Nitrogen. Ashley sought CERCLA cleanup costs for a defunct phosphate fertilizer manufacturing plant in Charleston, South Carolina. Although PCS never owned, operated, or ever set foot on that site, PCS was ultimately found liable, jointly and severally, for 76% of the cleanup costs. We believe that in reaching those conclusions, the district court erred, and I'd like to focus on three of those today, if I may. The first is successor liability, which is a threshold issue that, if reversed, would dispose of all the other issues. Second, if the court doesn't find for us on successor liability, is DeVille's ability, in which the district court, we believe, did not pay appropriate attention to the Supreme Court's teaching in Burlington Northern, and then finally, equitable allocation.
Before you get to the merits, you said it again, and you said it in your brief, that resolution of successor liability would resolve the case completely. I'm not sure that I agree with that, in part because there are still some questions with respect to other PRPs that inevitably will come back before the court, even if we were to wash this all away. What's your position on that?
They may come back before the court in another case, but as we read the case started by Ashley under a 107 claim against us. All the other claims in the case, the counterclaims, third-party claims, are 113 claims for contribution. If Ashley doesn't have a claim against PCS Nitrogen, all the rest of that is a bunch of noise.
But then Ashley would have a claim potentially against those other defendants as PRPs.
Right. If Ashley, they could sue them under 107 directly, which they haven't done, or they could sue them under 113 if Ashley paid too much and then ultimately wanted to contribute against them.
But I guess my point is the analysis would be the same. The findings that the court below made with respect to those parties would be the same. So what would be gained by sending the case back and having to start all over again with respect to those parties?
I understand Your Honor's point. We just believe that as a formal matter, that is, so long as the claim against against PCS Nitrogen is adjudicated not liable, that there's really nothing left to do.
And I know you don't really care once you're out.
I mean,
that's
really
also
your
certainly true, Your
is,
Honor.
If you let us out on the first claim, we're out.
Right. That would be fine too. Thank you. Turning first to successor liability, the district court erred in finding Anlinger to be a successor to CNC. The district court gave three reasons for finding Anlinger to be a successor to CSC. One was express assumption, the second was merger under South Carolina law, and the third was substantial continuity under federal common law. Starting first with the principal ground, the express assumption, we believe that under the plain language of the acquisition agreement, Anlinger did not assume liabilities for the Charleston facility. And here's why. The starting point here is this was an asset deal. Anlinger agreed to buy assets of CNC, specifically those assets related to the acquired business, which was defined as an ammonium and nitrate-based business. They agreed to buy the acquired business and the purchased assets. Those two terms are important limiting terms. In first and foremost, they are temporally limited. Anlinger was buying a business operating as of the date hereof, and it was buying assets as the same shall exist on the effective date. Both of those dates were October 31st, 1986. But Charleston had been raised 15 years before and sold a year before. CNC didn't have Charleston to sell. And we believe the Fifth Circuit's decision in Honeywell is dispositive here. Honeywell makes clear that when an asset agreement is structured to limit liabilities to those assets that exist as of the time of the agreement, then other liabilities from prior businesses don't transfer.
What do you make of the recitals portion of the agreement that suggests that, in fact, what is happening here is a stock purchase agreement, which would, if it were true, transfer not only the assets but the liabilities in their entirety?
Sure. It can't have been a straight stock sale, as even Mr. Bivens, who was the assistant general counsel for CNC, agreed. It can't have been a straight stock sale because, it cannot have been a straight stock sale of all of the stock of CNC, because remember that DSM was doing this transaction in part to capitalize on cashing out $100 million worth of tax credits. And as Mr. Bivens admitted in his deposition, had this been a stock sale, those tax credits would have transferred too, not just the environmental liabilities at Charleston, but also these tax credits. And you can find that in the record at JA12446. It makes sense. What was going on here was that Anlinger was buying a business at through these assets, but it was buying the nitrogen-based business. And it was buying those assets as if in a stock sale. That's what the recital describes what's going to happen. And then when you read the effective portions of the agreement...
Why would you need that language? That doesn't make any sense.
Because CNC was trying to be done with these assets and all the others that it distributed as part of this deal, the ones that went to Nipro, the ones that went to ASC, and it was trying to shut down the company to take care, to take advantage of its tax credits. And so to avoid Anlinger being able to come back, as you would be able to in a normal asset sale, under reps and warranties and say, gosh, there was this problem or that problem that you represented and warranted, Anlinger said, okay, as to this acquired business, as to the nitrogen-based business and the assets to run that business that we're purchasing, as to that, we will take that as if in a stock sale. We won't rely on those reps and warranties. We won't come back to you as against those assets.
Is that your understanding, or is that part of the record, that that explanation with respect to this particular clause?
It's my understanding, but it's also both Megidda and Krieger testified that this was not a stock deal, and even Bivens agreed that this was not a stock deal.
Well, all of this goes to whether, in fact, the contract, Judge Houck's first ruling about the contract requiring this to be a full sale. What about the alternative ruling, which he looked at extrinsic evidence?
We think the extrinsic evidence supports us as well.
Well, it may support you, but there is extrinsic evidence that also supports what Judge Houck decided. And we review for clear error, don't we?
You review extrinsic evidence fact findings for clear error, absolutely, Your Honor, and I'll embrace that. But we don't think you get there under the language of the agreement for two reasons. One, the liabilities assumed in Section 3 are clearly only those liabilities that relate to the acquired business or the purchased assets. And Judge Houck found in our favor, that the acquired business did not include, that the ammonium nitrogen-based business did not include Charleston. That's a factual finding that went in our favor. Once you've got that factual finding in our favor, all that's left is looking at what the liabilities are limited by, and that's by time. Both acquired business and purchased assets are limited to those things that existed as of the closing date, which no one disputes Charleston did not. The rest of this is all fighting over whether we can shoehorn successor liability into some other provision. And so Ashley tried Recital B, which we discussed, and I don't think works.
Well, if you look at Judge, You know this case a lot better than I do,
thank
to
you,
be
Ron.
Sure. But I've spent many more hours on it than I might have liked to. So
thank
if
you, Your
you
Honor.
If you can turn to 198 of the JA, where Judge Houck starts talking about extrinsic evidence, and it seems to me he comes up with four pieces of extrinsic evidence, and maybe they don't do the trick. Your assumption, but Judge Houck, the decision maker on this, he found they did. Why is that clearer?
Sure. You don't get to the extrinsic evidence and his fact findings until you decide that there's ambiguity in the relevant provisions to decide what you need to figure out if we're
okay,
a successor.
Okay, let's assume, just for purposes of my question, that we've decided there is ambiguity in the relevant provisions.
Okay. The kind of ambiguity...
Judge Houck said there wasn't ambiguity.
Originally he said there wasn't.
Right. But
then he went
has
through...
an alternative holding about extrinsic evidence.
Right. The extrinsic evidence all goes to the question. The problem is they don't come back to his holding. When he does the holding as to whether there was successor liability, what he ultimately grounds it on is 3.4. 3.4, which conveyed all first of all, which was subject to the intro paragraph in Section 3, which says, again, that Anlinger is assuming only those liabilities related to purchased assets and acquired business, which was not Charleston. But also 3.4 is limited to obligations, not any obligations, but obligations required to be performed under court, regulatory, or administrative orders that were applicable to CNC. And there was no CERCLA order. The only order listed in the schedule that had to do with that was a Georgia Environmental Department order on how to treat wastewater from the Augusta plant, by the way. A CERCLA order that didn't yet exist for inchoate liability can't meet the definition of 3.4. So you don't get to the extrinsic evidence. Yes, you don't get to the extrinsic evidence. And it's telling, by the way, that 3.6, which Ashley's raised as an alternative ground for affirmance here, would deal with these sorts of liabilities. 3.6 picks up any liabilities, whether or not known, whether or not yet asserted. That would be the relevant provision here, but again, it can't be because it's limited to those liabilities related to the acquired business and the purchased assets, which again...
Is your position that you cannot conclude that this contract is ambiguous?
It depends what you mean by ambiguous. Certainly there was a dispute among the parties as to what ammonia and nitrogen-based business meant. And the judge found our way on that. So there, we asserted that acquired business is not ambiguous, that it's temporally limited, as is purchased assets. The judge went in and did some fact-finding as to what one part of acquired business, the ammonia and nitrogen-based piece, meant, and then stopped there. And that went our way. The judge then went beyond that and said acquired business could be, I think fundamentally the judge misunderstood the argument that trial counsel was making, for whatever reason. And the judge said, well, acquired business can't be limited solely to the Augusta plant, because there were other assets that went along with part of the deal, the purchased assets. Those included the distribution terminal, the Wilson terminal in North Carolina. Those included a condo in Hilton Head. And the judge said, well, gosh, you're arguing that acquired business can only be the Augusta plant, and purchased assets can only be the Augusta plant. And since I disagree with that, I find it ambiguous and I have to look more broadly. We think that was a false dichotomy. Acquired business is business having to do with the ammonia and nitrogen-based fertilizer business, and purchased assets are the ones set out in the agreement. They include all those things. Those things were related to and helped in the operation of the nitrogen plant. But it didn't then go beyond that to include all prior liabilities for all businesses.
You're just disagreeing with how he read it. It's not impossible to get where he got. You don't agree with what he did. And, you know, God bless you. That's why we have lawsuits and appeals.
But as we're but in this world, then we're reading the contract, and this is de novo review. And frankly, we think this is the better reading of the agreement. So yes, de novo review as to what the contract means. Yes, we are disagreeing with what he found. But that's a de novo reading of the contract. So we believe our
we've agreed that the extrinsic evidence findings are factual findings.
But you can't look at factual.
You agree with that?
The extrinsic evidence findings. The problem is, they're factual findings of what? They're factual findings going
by what the extrinsic evidence demonstrates. I mean, frankly.
Oh, certainly, I agree.
If I'd been the district court, I might have concluded the extrinsic evidence went another way, and that's
right.
You argue that in your papers.
Right. Well, and I'm not trying to undo clear error fact findings. What I'm trying to say is that you can't look at the fact findings he made divorced from what the legal question was that he was trying to answer. You can absolutely find that there were, you know, letters sent out to creditors and whatever effect that might have, but you can't then apply that to what does acquired business means if the contract says that acquired business is limited temporally and doesn't include Charleston, because it doesn't include phosphate, and Charleston wasn't part of the owned assets at the time. Secondly, the district court had found a potential for successor liability under substantial continuity, relying on this court's Carolina Transformer decision. We're happy to rest on our briefs, but we think Best Foods pretty much is the end of Carolina Transformer, as the Second Circuit and every other court to consider the issue since Best Foods has recognized. And then finally, the district court had found consolidation or merger under South Carolina law. We believe that he misunderstood how far South Carolina law went. Remember that the district court had already found no merger under federal common law because there was not the same directors, there was not a full transfer of assets, none of those things. The court went on and said, but under South Carolina law, there could be a merger because ultimately following this transaction, there were not enough assets left in CNC to pay creditors. As a matter of law, we disagree that South Carolina law goes that broadly. Merger happens when one company takes enough of the assets from another that there's nothing left to that first company. In other words, the deprivation of assets from that first company has to come through the merger. That didn't happen here. Remember that as part of the acquisition of the nitrogen-based business, what CNC got was the Augusta plant and a couple related pieces. What it expressly did not take, because it was concerned about environmental liabilities that it knew about, was the land underneath the very plant it knew it was buying. It excluded from the transaction, Anlinger did, the land that CNC owned under the Augusta nitrogen business because it didn't want environmental liability. And that land ultimately went to NIPRO as part of the deal. There were also other assets that ended up going to ASCI, Augusta Services Company. And even at the end of all of that, at the end of this deal, there were still $14.5 million left in CNC for another month and a half or so. It wasn't this deal that put CNC out of credit and out of business. What happened was, under Delaware law, there's a provision for a final distribution and a wind-up. And that's what DSM ultimately did. DSM caused to be wound up CNC, ultimately by making a final distribution up to its parent NIPRO of the $14.5 million. So it wasn't as a result of anything that Anlinger did in buying assets that CNC stopped having dollars to pay creditors, it was because of a dissolution. And by the way, Delaware law provides that when a dissolution happens that way, CNC remains available, even though it's been shut down, for creditor claims up to 3 years after the transaction. So the district court's concern under South Carolina law that the Anlinger transaction had left the company without assets was, we just believe, a misreading of South Carolina law. So for all of those three reasons, we believe that successor liability, that finding against Anlinger was not appropriate. And if that's so, then we're happy to stop there. If the court doesn't agree with us on those points, I'll proceed to divisibility. On divisibility, my presentation is short. If PCS is a successor, it should not be held jointly and severally liable for the 76% of cleanup costs that the district court found. The beginning and the end, as Burlington Northern teaches us, is Section 433A of the Second Restatement of Torts that says if a harm from two parties can be divided, that can be done where there is a reasonable basis for determining the contribution of each. And keep in mind Burlington Northern and its facts. You had railroads that had leased a parcel to a company that was polluting, partially because fluids came out of the railroad companies, partially because fluids were coming out of the polluter itself. And the question was, how much shall we hold the railroads liable for? And the district court said there was no evidence presented by either party as to how to find divisibility here or how to do that. And the Ninth Circuit said, yeah, okay, if there's not any evidence, then it's not divisible. And the Supreme Court said no. 2 points. One, it's theoretically divisible. We can figure out whether these harms came from somebody else. And two, we in this record can find enough based on simple rudimentary considerations like how long did the railroads own that piece of land versus how long was the operation in existence? Or how big was the railroad's piece of land as opposed to the entire operation of the business? Or which of the contaminants did the polluting, and they multiplied that by 2/3. You multiply 1 by 2 by 3, and you get a 9% or a 6% share for the railroads. And the Supreme Court said even those rudimentary calculations are enough for divisibility. Here, the district court found, as fact, that there was theoretical divisibility here, that the harms could be divided by the different people. At that point, all PCS Nitrogen had to do was demonstrate to the court what its appropriate share was.
Well, but of course, the problem is that Burlington Northern didn't deal with the multiple parties that we have here. So it doesn't really tell us what has to be done in a situation where you have more than two people. And that's where your total reliance on Burlington Northern falls apart. I mean, I just think it's an open issue right now.
Fair enough, Your Honor, but I think the thrust of Burlington Northern is clear that you can't require absolute certainty as the percentages. It can't be PCS's burden to come to court and say, based on stoichiometry and everything else, it is exactly 6%, it is exactly 7%. And yet, we tried to do exactly that in as many ways as we could think of. We looked to Burlington Northern, and so we did. What's the period of ownership relevant to when they started making fertilizers on this site up until now, and what's our portion of that? And that comes out to approximately 6%. Then we tried our expert, Brian Murphy, who said that you can look at the volume of contaminants put onto the site. And using stoichiometry and chemical analysis, he came up with numbers ranging from 1% to 4% based on various of the pollutants. Then you went to the volume of soil, and Wayne Gripp looked at this like a giant bathtub. Remember how this happens. You had a Charleston plant producing phosphate fertilizer. The main source of the pollution comes from burning this pyrite slag, which was a process that even PCS's alleged successor or predecessor never used. This was only Ross, then Planters. That's where most of the pollution comes from. And so when they do that, they then take the unburned slag, put it on the site, and that's what causes the pollution, the arsenic and the lead and the low pH. And Grip said, if you look at this, you can tell which owner added which piece to this, like filling up a bathtub. And since the remediation is going to come from digging this stuff out and carrying it away to be disposed of somewhere else, I can figure that out on a percentage basis looking at what did PCS add to the bathtub. And again, that comes up with a volume of soil of about 4% responsibility. And then he also looked at, since some of the PRPs had been liable because they disturbed already contaminated soil, he looked at, well, through the years, looking through photographs, which was the first party to disturb all that contaminated soil? And again, looking at first party to disturb, he comes out with a number that's 6%. So all these things hone in right around a bullseye of 6%. If rough justice and rough approximation is what Burlington Northern holds is the standard, and it is, we think we well exceeded that.
But isn't that ultimately a credibility determination for the district court with respect to these experts? As I understood it, she found, Judge Seymour found, some inconsistencies in the expert testimony that suggested to her that there was no reasonable basis for making the apportionment here. What's wrong with that?
Certainly, Judge Seymour did notice a couple of what she viewed as inconsistencies along the way with one method or another. But ultimately, her holding, as I read it, rested on the proposition that there was no one method here, since some PRPs were responsible for moving dirt and some were responsible for placing pollutants on volume, if you will. There was no one method that showed both volume and dirt disturbance, and without that, she couldn't find to certainty what was PCS's contribution. And our point is that even Ashley's own expert, Stout, agreed that there was a sufficient basis in the evidence to find divisibility here. And she did the closest you can get to both moving and volume. She looked at photographs over the years as to who did the first moving. And then she also looked at samples from the site. So then she equated first move with how contaminated is that dirt where it was found. That's the closest you can get to moving and to samples. It certainly satisfies Burlington Northern's rough justice standard. If this record isn't sufficient, what is? I don't think we're asking this court to create a broad new legal standard that says, you know, this is the kind of evidence you need in every case. I think Judge Motz is absolutely right that each one of these environmental contamination cases will rise or fall on its own facts. But on the facts of this case, I just don't see what more we could have done to show divisibility in a world where the district court had found that there was theoretical divisibility. Finally, as to 113 allocation, all we would say is that for the reasons set out in our brief, we think that at the very least the share assigned to PCS was too high. And unless the court has any further questions on those issues, I'd like to save my argument for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Barefoot?
Hi, may it please the court. My name is Thomas Barefoot, and I'm a counsel for Ashley II of Charleston. And with my 12 minutes before you, I'd like to address three issues, and that's successor liability under the contract, divisibility, and Ashley's status, protected status as a bona fide prospective purchaser under the CERCLA statute. First, however, on the express assumption of liability under the contract. Ashley asserts, and the lower court found, that it was unambiguous that it assumed the environmental liabilities of Old CNC. It asserted the provision under Section 3.4, which talked about orders from all regulatory, court, and administrative. The other thing that the court found was that the overall intent of the contract was that what was being purchased was the corporation, Columbia Nitrogen Corporation, as it existed in October of 1986.
What if we should find the contract ambiguous?
If the contract is found to be ambiguous, then Judge Houck's ruling is replete with all considerations of various factual matters, and his determinations then are
what stand. What do you have to say in response to what your colleague on the other side has just said, which it doesn't, at least with respect to these extrinsic evidence, you couldn't base the decision on the extrinsic evidence because Judge Houck made contrary factual findings with respect to the agreement?
I'm not sure I understand that argument.
We were both listening to it, and I've done the best I can to recreate it. Maybe one of your colleagues can come up and respond.
Right. I mean, what Judge Houck did was he issued one of his alternative rulings was it's not ambiguous. Second of all,
that.
He said, well, you know, there's some cloud about what the acquired business was. And so then he started looking at the...
Best I understand their argument, as I say, both of us were in the courtroom, and you know this case a whole lot better than I do, but I believe their argument was it in finding that the contract was, along the way, in finding the contract was unambiguous your way, Judge Houck made a finding that would be fatal to your case in holding that extrinsic evidence would save the contract if we decided it was ambiguous. But you don't remember any of that.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. I mean, if the contract was ambiguous, his findings on the ambiguities should be affirmed unless they're clearly erroneous.
understand that. Maybe just try one more time, and then I'll let you go, and or you can argue whatever you want to. See, the thing is, I have to understand the case, you know? And so try to make me understand it. I assume for purposes of my question that Judge Houck's ultimate conclusion that the contract is unambiguous is error. So then you have to win on some alternative ground. And assume we then turn to the use of extrinsic evidence. Your colleague on the other side said, but in he had already made a finding that would make it impossible for you to prevail on the extrinsic evidence argument.
Well, I know I should have been asking you, but what finding could could there be?
Judge Howell, about a stock sale.
Well, we contend that the agreement is not ambiguous because of Recital B. They were selling the Corporation of Columbia Nitrogen. When you look at Section 1 of the agreement as to what's being sold, everything that is owned by the seller, except anything that's been retained, is being sold. That's the company.
What about the tax credits?
Well, everything except that's been retained or transferred to somebody else.
Was that specifically retained or transferred?
That's
how I understood his response was that couldn't be the case because otherwise primary benefit of this transaction would have been lost, i.e. the tax credits.
This was a unique contract, to say the least. We've tried to find a case in which there is a transaction that's structured as an asset purchase, and yet the very contract says it's to be interpreted and applied as if it's, you know, selling the stock of the corporation. These were sophisticated parties. They had preeminent lawyers doing it. They very deliberately drafted it the way they did. There were very high stakes involved. It had to go out of business. The corporation, Columbia Nitrogen Corporation, was being acquired.
Maybe they deliberately drafted it as an ambiguous agreement.
Well, they've argued that it's not ambiguous, but
Judge Schott,
so have you.
Well,
but
yes.
Judge Houck says here the court therefore holds that the definition of acquired business in Recital A is ambiguous, and that extrinsic evidence may be presented to determine what the parties intended to limit. On page 198 of the JA, 13 of the judge's findings, whatever they're called.
Yes, it was
findings of fact and conclusions of law, page 13, right in the middle of the page.
Right. He acquired business, he said, you know, Ashley says it's one way, PCS says it's another way, so I'm going to look at all the extrinsic evidence.
He says that it's ambiguous.
Right.
Right there in the middle of the page.
Right. Therefore holds. But then he later, after considering everything, finds that the meaning of the acquired business is, and this is at JA 201, Old CNC did not the acquired business includes all of Old CNC that was not specifically retained or sold to another entity. That's exactly what Section 1 in terms of what was being sold. It's the corporation. Everything that CNC owned, except that was being retained or transferred to somebody else, was being acquired under this. He went on to say,
but that's just after he bases it entirely on the extrinsic evidence. That part of the opinion, I think.
Well, he also based it.
He says he does.
He also based it.
I thought he did.
He also based it on the as-is, as if it's a stock deal. He said that it's obvious that they intended it to be this way, to sell everything of the corporation.
I read that on page 201, which the meaning of the term acquired business as falling under the caption on page 198 of extrinsic evidence. He has extrinsic
yes, he
evidence.
Yes, he got, says.
And then he's got five more headings. I think there are five more. Yeah, five more. Over to whether the transaction over to page 102. And that's all part of extrinsic evidence up to 202. Over to 202. Looks to me like. Maybe it's not.
That's the way it looks to me, too.
Yes. He said, after considering all of this extrinsic evidence, I come up with the same conclusion that acquired business means they're acquiring everything of Old CNC. It's not being sold or transferred to somebody else. That's the exact language of Section 1 of the agreement.
And he goes accordingly and sums it up on the top of page 202.
Exactly. And that's
And they included in the purchase a company that had released hazardous substances in the course of its production of phosphate fertilizer at the site in Charleston, South Carolina. Therefore, Olds CNC CERCLA liability for the hazardous release at the site relates to the acquired business, and new CNC assumed this liability.
And that's Ashley's position.
All that's under extrinsic evidence.
I mean, they were buying a corporation which includes what the current operations are, but it also includes liabilities for past activities that that same corporation had been engaged in. And that's what he found. And in this case, another piece of extrinsic evidence was the prospectus that Anlinger, the buyer, did, which was cited by the court and by PCS. At Joint Appendix 2474, summary of the investment opportunity, it's presently negotiating for the acquisition of Columbia Nitrogen Corporation. I mean, it's buying the business. And when it said on page Joint Appendix 2493, the description of the company, and it gives the history of the company incorporating 1982, further says, with the acquisition of Cotton States Fertilizer in 1965 and another company, the company's product line was expanded to include mixed granulated fertilizers. That's what the Charleston plant was. Goes on to the next page and says in 1982, this is Joint Appendix 2494, in 1982 granular fertilizer operations in Georgia were sold. So 4 years before this transaction, I mean, Anlinger knew they had that, those business operations. They knew that the plants in Georgia had been sold. Charleston had only been sold 1 year before this 1986 acquisition agreement. This wasn't some big mystery. Now, we admit that the land in Charleston wasn't sold. It had been sold earlier. But the liabilities that resulted from the release of hazardous substances on the site while Columbia Nitrogen operated it were liabilities of Columbia Nitrogen Corporation, the corporation that stayed with them, unless they're transferred someplace else. I would like to make another argument which maybe clarifies it on the unambiguous argument of Section 3.6. PCS admits that Section 3.6, which talks about all claims and litigation, would cover CERCLA liabilities. They circumscribe it to, well, it's got to, you know, it's got to relate to the acquired business, which they did, or it's got to relate to purchase assets. And in their brief, and that's at their reply brief, I believe it's at 15, they admit that there's an asset that was in existence in 1986 that covered CERCLA liabilities at the Charleston site. And that's the indemnity agreement that Planters, or Ross, gave Columbia Nitrogen when they purchased the site back in 1966. That contract agreement, nobody, Ashley didn't know about it at the time of the first trial, so it wasn't before the first trial. PCS subsequently filed its third-party claim on that indemnity agreement for CERCLA liability for the Charleston site. We've included that argument in our brief. Granted, it's kind of lost in the midst of all those pages. But what's important is PCS admits there was an asset, that 1966 agreement with Planters was an asset. After they were found to be successor, have successor liability, they asserted a third-party claim on that very indemnity agreement. In this litigation, and Judge Seymour in the Phase 2 trial said, yes, I mean, agreed with PCS saying, yes, that agreement is still valid and in effect today. And yes, it's broad enough to cover CERCLA liabilities at the Charleston facility.
Your time has expired, Mr. Thank you. Mr. Barr?
Please, the court. My name is Capers Barr. I'm a lawyer in Charleston, and I represent the parties known as Holcomb and Fair in this litigation, and Judge Motz let me begin with a disclaimer. When you looked over at our table and invited us to clarify some of this stuff relating to successor liability, I'm afraid I'm going to have to plead ignorant in that realm. And the court may be aware that procedurally this case was bifurcated, and the successor liability was tried only between PCS and Ashley. Once that was decided, PCS brought us
don't
all in.
Don't use up your time.
Thank you very much.
About what you want to talk about.
Thank you very much. Holcomb and Fair, Your Honors, were the first owners of this property in 79 years who didn't add contaminants. They've never been in the fertilizer business. They're realtors. They had listed the property for sale under an agreement with Columbia Nitrogen in 1975. When it didn't sell, Holcomb and Fair decided in 85 that they would buy it and use it as a site to lease for storing container trucks that serve the Port of Charleston. We've briefed three arguments. I have only 5 minutes, so I don't want to be too urgent in presenting them, but I'm certainly not going to reach all of those arguments. But I would like to touch on the first one, which is the argument that the district court erred in finding that Holcomb and Fair were responsible parties in the case. My guess is that most CERCLA defendants or parties who litigate in front of this court try to make that argument. But in this case, the basis for it is this. Judge Seymour found at JA 1859 that Holcomb and Fair's earth moving in the construction of a street redistributed contaminants and caused a dispersal of contaminants. And our argument is that because a reading of those references in the record don't support that conclusion, it amounts to clear error. The court cites the testimony of three witnesses, Grip, Murphy, and Freeman. However, those witnesses testified that generally soil disturbances can disperse contaminants, but they did not testify that it did in this case.
Was there testimony in the record that there had been extensive construction when you owned the site?
When we owned the site?
Yes.
The evidence in
during
the
time when you owned the site.
The evidence in the record was that we built a street, and I'm going to get into that.
That sounds like construction to me.
Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes, we're not disputing that.
And there's contamination all over the site.
There was contamination all over the site, but
So the district court could infer that your disturbance of the soil, combined with the fact that the soil's contaminated, made you a responsible party.
They could infer that, Your Honor, but the district court relies on the case of Red Wing Carriers against Saraland Apartments, an 11th Circuit decision, which I suggest holds that where a party is claimed to be liable for this kind of secondary activity, that is to say, where they didn't actually add contaminants, but they're being held liable for dispersal of soil, the evidence must find discreetly, specifically, that in fact that activity did disperse contaminants, and on that basis, these witnesses don't supply the key, and in fact. In its reply to this argument, PCS doesn't try to argue that, in fact, those witnesses said that contaminants were disturbed. In fact, PCS cites a piece of evidence that wasn't even relied upon by the trial judge, a cross-examination of one of our witnesses for that proposition. And it's our contention, the witness's name is Hutto. So inferentially, PCS must be conceding our argument that the evidence cited by the court wasn't sufficient. Secondly, the trial court didn't cite it, and she heard the testimony, did not cite this cross-examination of Hutto. She heard the testimony, she heard its context, she evaluated the witnesses, and she did not rely upon it in her findings. I've got my sum-up light on, so let me switch, if I may, just very briefly, because there's another issue in this case that probably larger and more fundamental, and we've briefed it both in our principal and reply brief, but it is that Columbia Nitrogen, PCS's successor, depending on this court ruling, but PCS's successor as we stand here today, Columbia Nitrogen knew that this site was contaminated, and they failed to report it to the EPA in 1980 after 1980 when CERCLA was enacted, but more seriously, they failed to disclose it to my clients before my clients purchased the property. I'll defer to my brief. I see my red light is up in terms of the points that I suggest for that. Thank you very much.
Mr. McQueenie?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Chip McQueenie. I represent the Appalee / Cross Appellant Ross Development Corporation. What I wanted to touch on, I'm sort of a standard review junkie a little bit. I used to do the outline for the South Carolina appellate courts. I want to touch on what I believe to be an error of law, which is in the interpretation of Section 113F1 by the district court, which this court reviews de novo. There's really no factual review that needs to be taken place. The issue is whether the district court erred in entering a money judgment against Ross in favor of PCS in the face of a lack of evidence that PCS has paid more than its proportionate share of liability for the response costs at the site. There's no evidence that PCS has paid more than its proportionate share of liability for the site. Despite that fact, the district court entered a money judgment in favor of PCS and against Ross.
The money judgment isn't payable until it does do it, is it? Isn't that right?
Well, it shouldn't be, but it's still a money judgment. I mean, it's
well, what would be the purpose of vacating it because it's not payable now, just to have it be reinstated when it is payable?
Because it assumes that PCS will end up paying more than its proportionate share liability for the site, which hasn't happened yet. Once that happens, then certainly...
But I understand no harm, no foul. You don't have to pay until your obligation comes due.
We wouldn't have to pay, but the court didn't really say that. And there's litigation that's ongoing that's seeking to attempt to collect on that money judgment at this time. And PCS has been using that money judgment in that litigation in order to sue the former Ross directors, the former shareholders, and Ross, alleging, for instance, that the former Ross directors breached a fiduciary duty to PCS as a creditor of Ross.
But nobody disputes that PCS can't collect its judgment until it has incurred response costs, right?
Correct. I don't think anyone disputes it, but it's in the court's order that they have a money judgment. Okay. And I agree. And PCS has filed a stay on appeal. The money judgment is not currently in effect. What I'm saying is that the portion of the order granting the money judgment should be reversed unless and until, and it's an unless and until, not just until, PCS pays more than its proportionate share, which she hasn't placed in her order.
I just don't understand how this, A, benefits you, and B, wouldn't be just a waste of court resources to go through this little dance. But
understood, Your Honor. I think it benefits us because we don't have a money judgment against us, and there's no reason for PCS to be coming against the former directors, the former.
Well, board. If you're maintaining that, that's a whole different issue.
It is.
I thought that was not the argument you were making. If you're saying that there is no basis for a money judgment, that's wholly different than saying she shouldn't have issued the money judgment now because there is no proof that they are ever going to come after you for this money judgment, that they're never going to make the... it's the latter argument that I thought you were making in front of us.
And Your Honor, I may be made a mistake in not explaining the whole procedural history. We've made that argument to the district court in the other case that because there shouldn't be a money judgment, and we made it before there was a money judgment, there's no money judgment, they don't have standing to sue at this time. The court subsequently entered a money judgment, which is why this is important to us at this time, because her order refusing to dismiss the case is based on the fact, in part, that they had a money judgment. It's being litigated on summary judgment, and it's actually currently stayed right now. But... it is an issue in that case that is being litigated between Ross and PCS about the standing of PCS, but we can't, as part of that action, appeal the money judgment that's been entered by the court. We have to address that in this action, and then if there's no money judgment in the other action, we would raise that to Judge Seymour, which we have done. And that's why it would not be a waste of judicial resources as well, Your Honor. It's as complicated as just about everything else in this case, and I apologize for not explaining that from the get-go.
No,
it's
probably me.
Unless the court has any other questions for me,
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'll be brief, Your Honor. It's been a long morning for the court, and with 27 volumes of joint appendix, I can appreciate the challenge. I represent Robin Hood Container Express, a small family-owned trucking company that utilizes 2 acres owned by Mr. Hood for the storage of empty storage containers. Our principal objection is this. Robin Hood occupies the only property that's in full compliance of all state environmental regulations. If you look at its historic, current, and future use as an industrial piece of property, it's within all of the regulations and the samplings set forth in the joint appendix at 11056 through 11058 confirms this. If one says, well, by the one piece of evidence cited by PCS is 11050, which was a receipt where Mr. Hood engaged a contractor to level the vegetation, put up a fence, the court said, well, that distributed contamination through the site. As the sampling, as I cited, on our property shows it's within compliance. If you look at the sampling immediately adjacent, where presumably any fair evidence would say that they distributed the contaminants, it likewise is clean. So the idea that Robin Hood, with a 2-acre parcel among this 43-acre thing, distributed contaminants throughout is somewhat of a stretch. So we feel that Robin Hood should not be part of this. They contributed no harm to Ashley's property. Their own property is uncontaminated. The fact that Ashley may have commissioned a study to remediate to a higher level, a residential standard of remediation of property it does not own, does not have a contractual right to, is preposterous.
And I thought the district court found that your client's parcel was contaminated.
And we believe that is clear error. If you look at what is cited in support of that, Your Honor, the where she says it's contaminated is to a residential standard. The residential standard is not the zoning of our property. It's not the use of our property. We have no intention of using it to a residential standard.
All right. Well, even if that's wrong, I guess your other argument is it doesn't affect, it didn't, there's no finding that it crossed over to the property that's being remediated that is the subject.
There's no evidence to support it crossed over at all.
But your property, EPA and Ashley, all identify your parcel as part of the site, and the site has been listed as a non-time critical removal action. How can you just subdivide your portion?
Your Honor,
of that?
The EPA is in their administrative record have completed 3 of their 9 required regulatory steps. We have had no opportunity to comment, participate, provide our own actions. We have never received the first letter from EPA or the South Carolina agency requiring us or asking us or inviting us to do one thing. The only communication we received from the EPA was in the 1990s asking us permission to drill a well on our property, which we gave, which they subsequently did not do. So the idea that the EPA has said this
My larger question is that everybody seems to realize that on the larger parcel there is contamination. And how can it be that you can section off a property that you buy later on down the road after it's all the whole parcel's been contaminated and say, not me, boss?
Well, number one, our property is not contaminated. If it's continued to be used,
but it's part of the parcel. Okay.
Well, I guess that is, Your Honor. And if I go back to the cases that describe this, they talk about contaminants that freely flow from one side to another. Here we have solid-based contaminants that are not essentially freely flowing. I mean, I see my time is up.
But is Ashley going to, if there was contamination on your property, is it going to be Ashley's responsibility to incur those cleanup costs?
Because no.
That's the bottom line.
No.
Right?
No, they have no right to, and they will have no obligation to.
And therefore you have no obligation to contribute.
And I didn't contaminate their property, so I have no obligation to them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me, may it please the court. Lewis Jones for the DSM defendants. I will address primarily the alter ego claim and urge the court to affirm the order of Judge Seymour dismissing the alter ego claims against the DSM defendants. I have five main points. The first is that here we're interpreting South Carolina law, so the controlling authority is the South Carolina Supreme Court. The question is what the South Carolina Supreme Court would do, and the controlling precedent is Drury Development Corporation versus Foundation Insurance Company. Now, Judge Seymour dismissed the South Carolina law veil-piercing claim correctly, and that has not been appealed. So the only question that PCS has included in its appeal here is Judge Seymour's dismissal of its alternative theory that is called the single business enterprise theory of corporate liability. That's what they argued and briefed in the case below. They have a slightly different theory that they've advanced on appeal. But the question is whether this single business enterprise theory of liability is in fact a veil-piercing theory. If it is a veil-piercing theory, and I don't see how it can be anything but, then it is clearly foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decision in Drury. Drury holds that the fundamental unfairness must be shown before the corporate veil can be pierced under any theory. The single business enterprise theory would dispense with that requirement and is therefore inconsistent with South Carolina law. As to whether or not it is a veil-piercing theory, PCS argues in its reply brief that it's not. But remember, the United States Supreme Court in Best Foods identifies the two types of theories that you claims that you can bring against a corporation under CERCLA. You can have a direct liability claim based on things that the corporation did itself, or you can have an indirect liability claim based on something, the corporation's involvement or relationship to an affiliate that did something that incurred CERCLA liability. PCS initially brought, but then expressly waived its direct liability claims against the DSM defendants. So all that it had left were indirect liability claims. And the Supreme Court in Best Foods expressly held that an indirect liability claim may be brought when, but only when, it is possible to pierce the veil against the defendant. And so what that means is that the type of claims that PCS preserved are precisely the types of claims, veil-piercing claims, to which Drury applies, which means there has to be a showing of fundamental unfairness. And if there's not, the claim was properly dismissed. If it's not a veil-piercing claim, if it's something else, as they claim in their reply brief, then it was waived. It was waived not only because PCS expressly waived all direct liability claims, but also because the authorities that they cited in their brief discussed it as a veil-piercing claim. They relied primarily on the Texas case, now abrogated, of Hoffman v. Dandurand. Hoffman describes the single business enterprise theory as, I quote, a method of piercing the corporate veil, close quote. That's 180 Southwest 3rd, page 348. Now, the new theory that PCS has invoked on appeal, based on South Carolina cases that they did not cite below, is something different. It's something called the amalgamation of interests theory. There's three Court of Appeals cases that have discussed this theory, and let me note here that there are Court of Appeals.
Two of them were about the same party.
All three of them. It's been invoked in three cases, all construction defect cases, where the target was the same individual, a guy named Roger Van Wee, who kept setting up sort of sham corporations. He was a home builder. These are the only three cases where this theory has been invoked. And because of that, it's very hard to abstract from those three cases to know how generally applicable the theory is. I would note, and the case, there's no attempt to identify factors to be applied or to explain the theoretical basis of it. But the one thing is that in all three cases, the court made a point that the defendant, target corporation in those cases, had directly held itself out to the plaintiff as the entity responsible for the construction defects at issue in those three cases. That's not an issue in our case. That's a fact that's just not present. And, of course, because this theory wasn't advanced below, there was no opportunity to address these issues.
You say it's been waived?
It was waived. It's absolutely waived. There's no discussion of this in the district court. And on that point, in fact, I'd note that counsel expressly acknowledged to the district court that the theory they were advancing, the single business enterprise theory that they were advancing below, had never been adopted by any South Carolina court. and I'll just quote, this is counsel for PCS at the February 2, 2009 argument. Let me address the law here, Your Honor. The single business enterprise theory has been adopted in a number of states, but has not been adopted specifically in South Carolina. So it's very clear that at that time, counsel acknowledged this was not the law of South Carolina. It's also very clear that the new cases based on South Carolina law are completely new. It's not what they argued below.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Luck?
May it please the court. My name is Jason Luck. I'm here representing All Waste Tank Cleaning Incorporated, formerly known as PSC Container Services, LLC, now known as Koala Services, LLC, call us All Waste. We were the owner of 3 acres of the facility that we purchased from Mast Tank Cleaning, who in turn purchased it from Holcomb and Fair. We also leased 2 acres of the facility as well. We were a tank cleaning business. We are appellees. We are bound to argue that this court should affirm the district court's decision, and we do so. However, because certain parties have at least argued that equitable apportionment should be reapportioned, and because that this court has the power to do such a reapportionment, we have also provided in our brief arguments for possible reapportionment, and I'm here to take any questions about that if you have any.
You only got 3%, didn't you?
Yes, Your Honor, I did. We did.
Is your client's going to be indemnified?
Yes, Your Honor, according to the law.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Murray, I don't want to interrupt you. I don't want you to have your whole 10 minutes. I want you to try me one more time on why Judge Houck's alternative holding about the ambiguity of the contract should not stand.
Sure. 2 points on that, Your Honor. We've made the vacator argument, but given the vacator argument, but given that Judge Houck was actively seeking employment from Ashley's lead lawyers, as Judge Seymour found, there was an appearance of impropriety attributable to Judge Houck. So we've asked that that original finding of successor liability be vacated, which obviously gives us concern with the factual findings and what level of deference ought to be attributed to them. If Your Honors aren't willing to look behind the facts, at the very least, we would suggest that vacator is appropriate given that conflict of interest, which Judge Seymour found as the later judge who took the case. But even besides that, to Judge Motz's point, it was Ashley's burden to show that PCS was a successor, and specifically that Anlinger...
Can you talk up just a tad?
I'm sorry.
I'm sure that your colleague hears this argument.
And specifically that Anlinger was a successor to CNC. And citing JA 201... the district court went through these 4 pieces of extrinsic evidence that Your Honors have already pointed to before reaching that, what you call the alternative holding, that the parties intended the transaction tantamount to a sale, that old CNC had to be dead and buried, that there was a discounted price, and it sold substantially all of the assets. None of those factual findings gets to my specific point, which is the assumed liabilities. Again, this is an asset deal, not a stock sale. None of those points gets to the fundamental point that both the assumed liabilities are limited to acquired business and purchased assets, and both of those terms, under the plain language of the agreement, are temporally limited to something that exists that is owned by CNC as of the time of the transaction, which was simply not true of the Charleston site. And so, since these environmental liabilities related to the Charleston site, which was not owned, they were not assumed by my client, which is why...
I think their argument is that the liabilities still rested on your client.
That's their argument, which is why my learned brother for Ashley kept saying that, you know, they were buying a corporation. They were buying a corporation. Well, we emphatically, Anlinger affirmatively was not buying a corporation. They were buying assets. And when you buy assets, you only assume the liabilities that you expressly assume, which here are temporally limited. That's the whole point of Honeywell. If we had wanted to assume these other liabilities from prior businesses that CNC used to do, that they were no longer involved in, they could have, and this is what Honeywell teaches, they could have said that we assume liabilities related to the acquired business, the purchased assets, or any other line of business, including phosphate, which was not what we purchased.
How do you get around the fact he says it's ambiguous?
The point is...
It's ambiguous.
Sure, and that's a matter of law for Your Honors to decide. We don't believe it's ambiguous. But if it is ambiguous, all of the evidentiary findings he makes don't go to our point, which is you can believe everything he said, and we should still win as a matter of law because it was temporally limited. We can't acquire liabilities related to an asset that was not part of what we bought. We only acquired liabilities that were related to purchased assets and acquired business, both of which temporarily had to exist on the date we bought them. Charleston did not. And you can tell that this is true. I mean, we've heard from Ashley. They're going so far as to say that maybe because we bought some trademarks and environmental liabilities were related to those, or they're straining to say that they're related to some sort of a indemnity agreement, which they retained, which we weren't produced until later in this case, and which their own corporate rep, Kirby, took the position was their business record, which was expressly a retained asset. We've briefed that, but it's at JA2396 in paragraph 3.
Okay. And I thought you relied on some other finding by Judge Howe.
We did, Your Honor.
And what is that?
Let me see if I can recreate that, too. The point is, there was the only possible ambiguity. There's two terms here, both of which are temporally limited. The liabilities have to relate to purchased assets or acquired business. Nobody's arguing that purchased assets is ambiguous because they're spelled out right in the agreement. To the extent there's an ambiguity in acquired business, it was one the judge found in our favor on, which was that an ammonia and nitrogen-based business was referring to Augusta, not Charleston.
Where is that in his order?
And forgive me, I don't have it in front of me as I stand here.
201, 202.
It's right about 202.
He says that, and then the same sentence says that you bought a company, or CNC bought a company that had released hazardous substances in the course of its production of phosphate fertilizer at the site in Charleston, South Carolina. Accordingly, at the top of the page.
Right. And that's respectfully there. We didn't buy a company. We bought assets.
No, but he says you did. That's his
we
finding.
We understand your position.
Right.
We're trying to get.
That's his. But this is Judge Houck's finding.
Yes, Your Honor. And that.
And so what do you say that then is, or at least half of the sentence is clear error?
No, it's wrong as a matter of law under which folks.
You're saying it's not reviewed for clear error.
No, that particular finding
he's
is reviewed.
He's saying an acquired business. And he explains that and says you bought a company at Charleston that released the stuff at the site in South Charleston, South Carolina.
Right. Whether we bought a company or whether we bought assets is a legal question, which comes to you folks de novo. The only clear error questions are these individual factual findings as to what happened.
So you say it's not reviewed for clear error, it's reviewed de novo.
Not that. No, Your Honor. Yes, exactly.
And that it's de novo error.
Yes, absolutely.
So you have to do both those things.
Yes. And the JA-188, paragraph 13, I see my time is running out here, is where you'd find old CNC produced ammonia and nitrogen products at a plant in Augusta, Georgia, not South Carolina, where these environmental liabilities are.
Well, okay, but you're wrapping yourself around that, quote, finding,
right.
But you're disavowing this later, quote, finding. Why shouldn't we do just the reverse?
Because the later finding is a legal finding, right? All I'm saying here is, when you read the language of the agreement,
well,
you can consider
the court finds that acquired business includes all of old CNC that was not specifically retained or sold to another entity.
Right, and that can't be right.
Old CNC did not specifically retain its circle of liability.
That's a legal question, which Your Honor's reviewed de novo, and
the term finding is usually connected to facts, and legal issues are talked about as conclusions.
And
indeed, I think that's what he says right at the beginning. That's what the rules talk about.
Well,
rules of civil procedure talk about that way.
This court has never been bound by formalistic labels that district courts apply to things.
So you don't want us to be bound by a formal label, Judge Howe, could he's finding.
No, and here's why. Again, what he says is we bought a company, and that's self-evidently not true. All the evidence was this was an asset deal.
Oh,
the agreement
but we have to
says.
Reject that.
Right. That, as a legal matter. We didn't buy a company, we bought assets. And as soon as you agree that we bought assets and you look at the assets we bought, the acquired business and the purchased assets.
He says he's saying what the acquired business was. That's what he's talking about here on page 202.
Right.
He says that all this external evidence leads him to the conclusion that the acquired business included this liability.
But if you look at the recitals here, I understand absolutely, Aaron. I understand just what he's saying. I don't think that's a factual finding. I think it's a legal finding that has to be wrong as to what the acquired business consists of. It has to be wrong.
And that's the key part of this case.
Yes. Okay. It has to be wrong because acquired.
The nub here. After
but why? If that is, I mean, it went to trial. I mean, I understand that you think it's wrong, but the case was tried.
The case was tried because there was this ambiguity as to what an ammonia and nitrogen-based business
there's
was.
Ambiguity, there's a jury question, right?
Right. Well, it wasn't a jury. It was a bench trial.
Tried, then it's like having a verdict.
It was a bench trial, Your Honor.
This is all about intent, right?
A bench trial, a judge decides, but what the judge does is like rendering a verdict. They don't have a jury there.
Absolutely.
The judge makes findings of fact and conclusions of law, and that's what happened here.
Absolutely. And my point is, you can't say that the acquired business included liabilities that were expressed. The acquired business, the liabilities had to relate to the acquired business. The acquired business, in turn, whatever you find from the extrinsic evidence, the acquired business under the pure terms of the contract had to exist as of the time of the contract. And these old liabilities, the site to which they were attached, did not exist as of the time of the contract.
That's what you think the contract says. But Judge Howe found it ambiguous and concluded that this external evidence meant something else.
And the only way to get there is to read out the temporal limitation that Honeywell says is the focus in an asset deal like this. Anything else makes this a stock deal, which it couldn't have been because we didn't get the tax credits.
Well, but that's ambiguous too, because the language is in there with respect to the transaction being like a stock deal.
As if.
As if.
It's like a stock deal as to the acquired business. Only, and all that means is that as to the ammonia and nitrogen-based business and the related assets that we bought, we took them as is without reps and warranties. It couldn't have been a stock deal of all of CNC's stock because, again, the land underneath the very plant we bought, we were concerned.
But all of that is extrinsic evidence that you only get to if you find the contract to be ambiguous.
I agree. And given the clear temporal limitations in the contract and the clear authority of Honeywell, I don't think you get there.
What about the fact that what we're talking about here really is contractual intent, which is a quintessential issue of fact if it were brought in front of a jury?
This court has held, as of many courts, I couldn't give a specific case, that the best place to find contractual intent is in the language of the contract, which here temporally limited.
If not ambiguous.
Right. You can't get past the temporal limitation.
Unless it's ambiguous, and then you look behind it.
You can't get past the temporal limitation.
But he says that here in page 198.
Whatever the acquired business or the purchased assets were, they had to exist as of the time that the transaction closed in 86. Charleston was raised 15 years before, and the land was sold a year before. It did not exist. It was not part of CNC at the time. It couldn't be something that that Anlinger acquired, making us successorly liable. Unless the court has questions.
Do you want to address anything else? I'll give the other side the same. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Barefoot?
I reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, but I didn't get a chance to address the issues I noticed in the appeal on, and the counsel over here never addressed them either. So if I have 3 minutes, I'd love to talk.
You have 3 minutes.
Three minutes. Clock's running.
Thank you. I wanted to address one point on divisibility. Divisibility is not even potentially feasible in this case because they never addressed the groundwater remedy. He said in his reply, PCS said in his response brief that no groundwater remedy is needed now. That's not true. He cited a document, actually presented a new proposal to remedy to the site, which he cited, and he said that did away with the groundwater remedy. If you look at the exact page, which is at Joint Appendix 11184, it gives a breakdown, and it specifically says groundwater remedy is $2,428,000. We changed the remedy, but the groundwater is contaminated. It has to be addressed, and in every one of their divisibility arguments about allocation, they just said nothing about groundwater and what caused it and where it is and what factors and migrating and so forth. On the primary issue of Ashley's BFPP status, and there's no way I can address it now in a minute and 45 seconds, but what I want to impress upon the court, both in Ashley's primary brief and even more so in the reply brief, is that the district court's ruling on Ashley's BFPP status has really disrupted the brownfields community across the country. She applied standards to terms in the brownfields amendments in 2002, which were designed to do away with urban blight, etc. BFPP status is a limitation of liability. It's a liability protection. It's not a defense, and it shouldn't be. The elements of it shouldn't be construed as a CERCLA defense under 107, which are liberally applied to bring in everybody as a liable party. So I really want the court to look at that. One of the things was Ashley didn't meet the no affiliation requirement because it gave a release to Holcomb & Fair. That's just not what the statute says. EPA, after this case was decided, EPA came out with a new guidance document and say, wait a minute, we're saying that this no affiliation is to prevent fraudulent transfer of CERCLA liability, and we view certain indemnity agreements as being okay. However, footnote, see this Ashley 2 case down in Charleston, beware. I mean, the Brownfields community on this decision is in an uproar about how can we now go in and voluntarily take ownership of contaminated property and remediate it when we're going to face these same liability standards that the responsible parties that caused the contamination did.
Well, but aside from the no affiliation issue, she found other bases for denying the defense in this case, whatever you want to call it, the failure to take appropriate care, the disposal arguments. I mean, those are factual findings that
she applied the wrong standard. I mean, if you look at it, the appropriate care standard applies once you discover. She applied that to a debris pile that had 1 gallon cans of waste paint in it. It was housekeeping matters. We're dealing with a very contaminated piece of property. We were coming in to clean it up, redevelop it. We had done, in this Magnolia project, there were 21 total properties. 20 of them, there were 4 CERCLA sites, including this one in that major project, and 18 other voluntary sites with South Carolina DHEC that we were participating in the cleanup. This site was the only one that Ashley was involved in that the responsible party didn't participate in the cleanup with. And yet we are hooked with liability for 1 gallon paint cans for a debris pile that had waste tires, et cetera. She just made, you know, like it's a one molecule release type of argument. And even on disposal, the problem with applying the standard of disposal that the Fourth Circuit has ruled in NURAD and various other cases where if you've got a leaking tank, a leaking underground landfill or an impoundment, if it's leaking, you're going to be liable as a disposal. A BFPP comes in and has to inquire, make all due inquiries as best it can to find out the nature of the contamination, and yet if there is any kind of container on that site that's leaking, you lose your liability protection. A different standard has to apply to encourage people to come on and buy this property and remediate it. So she made factual findings but applied to an incorrect standard.
We have one more rebuttal. Thank you very much. We'll ask the clerk to adjourn court, and then we'll come down and greet the lawyers.